This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. This is the first of sort of a double bill to celebrate Apollo 11, which I like to celebrate every day. But everybody seems to be celebrating at the moment because we're at a round number anniversary. And for me, Apollo 11 is all about science and exploration. And we've got an episode all about the HBO series From the Earth to the Moon, where we speak to Alan Bean from Apollo 12, Fred Hayes from Apollo 13, Graham Yost, and, well, people involved in the making of that wonderful HBO series all about the Apollo missions. So that has become quite a big episode in its own right. But I also, while I was researching this episode, spoke to three scientists who are doing really interesting, really wonderful bits of science and exploration today, such as exploring the lava tubes on Hawaii so that one day we might build habitats in the lava tubes of the Moon and Mars, exploring human and elephant conflict in Kenya, and heading to the Arctic to see how climate change is affecting our planet. So we're going to hear from Michaela Musilova on Hawaii, Emma Brisdian in the Arctic, and Lizzie Daly, actually at Cheltenham Science Festival, but just about to depart to research that elephant-human conflict. We begin with Michaela. Michaela Musilova is a friend of the Shed, having appeared first on our episode way back when with Chris Hadfield, when we talked about The Martian, the book, even before the film came out. And Michaela continues to have a wonderful career and is now director of the High Seas missions on Hawaii. I began by asking her just what that job entails.
It's a very diverse job. I like it because it feels like I don't do the same thing at all every day. It's always something new and exciting. But I guess my main role is to organize missions at the station, communicating with researchers all around the world, different space agencies, because now we've opened up to the whole world. It's not just focused on NASA. And so I'm actually liaising with people all around, discussing research projects and technologies and missions they would like to perform at the station. And then it's all about kind of, you know, scheduling them, organizing them to run smoothly. We've also been doing a lot of upgrades to the habitat since last year. We've kind of completely renewed what we could on the inside, upgraded a lot of the systems. And we use every mission to gather feedback from the participants in the mission on how we can, you know, improve the way it's run, the technologies there, the scientific projects, etc. And then we use the time in between missions to kind of make those upgrades. So we had several missions at the end of last year, short duration, and we had a slightly longer 2-week mission with the European Space Agency earlier this year. And we have several more with the European Space Agency planned later this year. And then we also won a grant in cooperation with various American institutions, including NASA, but for bureaucratic reasons, we're still waiting to see exactly when that will start again. And so all of these missions are shorter duration because, as I mentioned, the primary focus is not, you know, psychological effects on the human participants anymore. It's testing different technology and experiments during those missions, which don't necessarily require, you know, months on end for humans to be locked up on quote unquote Mars or the Moon. But instead, you know, we can test them in these simulated conditions on another planetary body, but only several days or several weeks are necessary for that. My role is to organize, run those, but sometimes I'm asked to be actually part of the crew. Cool. So I also get to be part of missions. So, for example, I was commander of the mission with the European Space Agency earlier this year. So then I kind of have a dual role of, on one hand, making sure everything is going to be organized and working smoothly while I'm in mission. But then when I'm in the mission, you know, I'm on the Moon or I'm wherever they put me, and I need to do that, you know, commit to that role fully.
What does the mission look like?
These short missions are focused on the Moon. And this is because, you know, in reality, the Moon is so much closer to the Earth than Mars. And, you know, with Mars, at the moment, we're talking about approximately 8 months to just get there, approximately every 2 years when there's a, you know, the right window, when the Earth and Mars aren't too far away from each other. And once you're on Mars, you're very much independent. There's a time delay of approximately 20 minutes each way, and there are times when it could take up to 45 minutes for you to get an answer from NASA, even if it was, you know, a critical, urgent situation. And, you know, for those of you that have seen or read The Martian, you know exactly what I'm talking about, where if something goes wrong, it's completely up to you on the surface of Mars and your team that you're there with to figure out a solution or to deal with it. But the moon, luckily, you know, it's so much closer. The time delay there is only about 3 seconds on average, or return a message. So it's almost like being able to talk real time. So it takes, you know, almost the same amount of time as on Earth to send and receive messages. Okay, you might not be able to have a live communication, but the delay doesn't really have a huge effect on your mission. People have been there before, so, you know, it's so much easier to kind of get us back there than it is to go to new territory like Mars that's so far away. Also, you don't have to take quite as many things with you, because you can have more regular resupply missions to the moon than to Mars. And there's a number of other logistical things which make missions to the moon much simpler compared to Mars. And that's why our missions are kind of done in a different way. So yeah, we have this very tiny time delay. It means we can still communicate with Earth a lot. We're, I would say, much more dependent on the mission control center, say, you know, equivalent of NASA Houston, than, you know, people on Mars would be. They would be, on the contrary, completely independent, and mission control would kind of be checking up on them if everything's going okay, if they need anything. But during the day, they would be completely autonomous. Whereas with the moon, there are more checkups happening. We do have to request more permissions to do certain things, get approval for the protocols and projects we want to perform. And so while we're in this mission, so we're simulating actually being on the surface of the moon. So we've, you know, we're not simulating the journey there or back. We've basically arrived there on a quote-unquote space shuttle. We've been, you know, left inside this small dome. It's about 12 meters in diameter, but has a pretty tall ceiling, which makes it much more comfortable to be on the inside. So even though there's six of us in this tiny space, it feels like we have, you know, enough air to breathe, sort of thing. Whereas, for example, when I did research at the Mars Desert Research Station a few years back, it has only 8 meters in diameter. It's a cylinder, but it's a two-story building. But the ceiling there is much lower, and it definitely feels much more claustrophobic, and even the sleeping quarters and everything. And so here, when you're inside, you know, it's kind of like you're on Earth. You don't have to wear a spacesuit. You can, you know, breathe and function normally. But to go outside into, let's say, the lunar terrain, you have to put on a simulated spacesuit. There's an airlock where you go through special protocol to actually, you know, put on the spacesuit and then go outside without bringing dangerous outside air and conditions into the inside of habitat. Then you can only be outside in the spacesuit doing research for a certain amount of hours until you run out of your air supply and other needs. And just to explain, so the station here in Hawaii is built on a volcano, Mauna Loa. It's approximately 2,500 meters high up. And the site was chosen for a number of reasons, but in particular, we know we're looking for a place that looks like the moon or Mars, where the actual geological terrain around us is relevant to doing planetary science research. And that way, you know, when we go on these simulated moonwalks or EVAs, as we call them, extravehicular activity, we're actually doing research relevant to, you know, what would be happening on the moon. For example, like researching lava tubes and whether we could build habitats inside lava tubes, which is what is an idea for future lunar colonies, is to actually use the existing natural lava tube there to build habitats in there and create natural protection for the humans, rather than, you know, building something on the surface of the moon with really thick walls to protect us from radiation and meteorite bombardment. And then on the other hand, for example, on Mars, even in this day and age, we think there might be some microbial life forms that could exist in these lava tubes. and just explain, lava tubes are like tunnels made by lava flow during an eruption. And what happens is that you have hot lava flowing down slope, and the outer layer reacts with air and water draining, and basically it solidifies quickly, creates a thin kind of crust, protective crust for the lava. And once the hot lava flows through, it kind of just leaves this empty tunnel. And there are all sorts of tunnels all over, you know, volcanic environment, whether here on this island, Big Island of Hawaii, or on the moon or Mars. And so when we go and do research, you know, we're literally focusing on things relevant to being able to do research on the moon or Mars.
You're going into lava tunnels on the volcano in Hawaii.
Yes, exactly. So it's one of the big highlights of the missions here is that there's a whole network of lava tunnels all around the research station or the high sea station. So we do spend a lot of the time on EVAs actually trying to find new lava tunnels, find ways to actually enter them, because it's very difficult to get inside with a spacesuit at times.
Yeah.
And then actually even moving around them. So we've added all sorts of knee protection and arm protection things to the spacesuit, because these lava environments can actually be very tricky to work in. They're rather sharp, and sometimes it can actually be dangerous. So it's difficult to do missions there, and that's kind of part of the challenge. And as commander, I always have to kind of evaluate whether it's safe to go to certain places, because, again, in a real-life situation on another planet, if something bad were to happen, we first have to treat it as if, you know, we're on the moon. What are we going to do? How are we going to get this person back to the habitat, even though they're injured? How are we going to treat them? But of course, if it would be a life or death situation, then we would have to call emergency services. But as far as we can, we would try and treat it, you know, properly and be inside the simulation.
Okay. I mean, I get it's slightly off topic, but it just makes me think of, you know, the War of the Worlds, the old Jeff Wayne thing, and that song. Start all over again, underground. And living underground on Mars just seems like kind of maybe World of the Worlds 2 is taking place.
I mean, yeah, it's an interesting one, because, you know, for so long we've thought about building habitats on the surface. You know, when you see all these pictures of these domes or whatever other kind of buildings, you know, in the red Martian terrain, for example, or even on the moon. But in reality, it would just be so much more difficult to have to build something like that rather than, you know, for example, use naturally made things like lava tunnels for natural protection, instead of which you can build a habitat that doesn't have super thick walls, that, you know, has other things that you could bring with you to Mars and focus on that, rather than focusing on that, you know, simple technology of how to build something thick and protective enough for the humans. And, you know, there were even ideas of like drilling things underground or whatever, for example, for Mars. But you have all these natural places that are already, you know, there because there used to be volcanic activity or various other things that created these spaces underground. Then why not use that? And so the focus has shifted a lot, and more researchers around the world think that actually, yes, we should use these underground, you know, pre-existing spaces to build future colonies, rather than, you know, trying to reinvent the wheel and build things on the surface, which is going to be very complicated for everyone.
Mm. I saw a Curiosity recently found clay in Gale Crater on Mars. Does that kind of, does all the latest science that's discoveries feed into what you're doing there as well?
Yeah, it influences the kind of research projects people suggest to have performed during our mission. So, you know, depending on the kind of mission, there would be a call for participants, actually crew members, to be part of the mission, you know, to be the simulated astronauts. But then we also give opportunities to researchers all around the world to design technologies or experiments that we then perform during our mission. And so all those experiments depend on, you know, the latest news in science. If define something that's gonna. So let's just give a example for a situation. If for some reason someone found evidence that whatever lava tubes are not interesting anymore for finding life on Mars, then and you know the whole research community agreed, that's pointless. We couldn't possibly find anything there. Then of course we wouldn't be doing research during our missions that would focus on collecting biological samples and lava tunnels to see if something similar could exist on Mars. We would have to change that focus completely. And vice versa, if someone developed a really cool 3D printer that can use lava rock, whether terrestrial lava rock or rock, you know, on the moon or Mars, to 3D print things in a very efficient way, then we would want to bring this technology in and test it, you know, in our simulated environment so that, you know, one day we'll actually be able to use it on the moon or Mars.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, because we're coming up to what, 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. And where are we at the moment? Are we getting closer to getting back? Do you feel like it's slipped?
I think what's slipping is Mars. You know, that has been my primary focus for many years until last year. And, you know, I always joke that when I worked for NASA, when people would ask, oh, so when are we going to Mars? They would be like, oh, in 30 years. But we've been saying this for 30 years. You know, it's like it's always being postponed because it's mostly linked to government and in need of a lot of money. So, you know, whenever there's a shift in that, NASA's hands are a bit tied and they have to focus on whatever basically the current administration tells them to. And other space agencies around the world don't quite have such ambitious plans yet. And that's why I am kind of waiting for them all to join hands and the commercial sector and all that to actually get us to Mars at some point. But in the meantime, even the commercial sector has changed focus to the moon as well. It's becoming almost like a new space race of some sort where you have different companies that are like, yeah, well, you know, we'll get you to the moon. And then different companies that focus on just the landing part and the technologies related to that. And you have different, you know, space agencies. Even NASA declared they're going to get humans back to the moon in 2024, which would be a miracle if that happens. But, you know, so be it. We'll get humans to the moon again. That'd be great. If it all continues in this way, you know, and competition might finally spur things to happen, we would be able to get back to the moon in the next decade or so, which would be great. At least it would be a giant step for humans again, but it would help us get closer to Mars just simply by, you know, getting more and more entities involved in this kind of space race. All these technologies and experiments would be tested directly on the moon, and most of them would be relevant in some way to getting humans to Mars one day. And so it's definitely a great thing that, you know, there is so much more interest for the moon again. And the organization I work for, we're called the International Moonbase Alliance. Our goal is to kind of help put together all these major players that are interested in getting humans to the moon. And my boss, his dream is to get humans to the moon by 2030, which I think is a much more reasonable estimate than 2024. And so one of the things we're doing is we're currently using the High Seas Station for, you know, test all these smaller research experiments, the technologies, but also psychological experiments, depending on the mission. But gradually we will actually want to shift to building a much bigger station also here on the Big Island, also on the volcano Mauna Loa, where it would become almost like a prototype of the station he one day wants to build on the moon. So we would literally test all possible technologies and everything, build a prototype moon base, and then hopefully the same thing with upgrades on the moon in the near future.
Can you walk through them or do you have to crawl through them?
Yeah, so some lava tubes, you know, they're, it's amazing. So for example, so during the last mission I was in the European Space Agency, I was helping a geochemist collect some biological residue that microbes leave inside lava tubes. And then they, again, kind of study what kind of microbes probably left that and if we could find similar biomarkers on Mars or the moon or et cetera. And so I was helping him collect these samples and we were literally trying to find as many lava tubes and tunnels as possible to collect samples for him. And at one point, I find this like really small cave type of thing. So we go inside and collect samples for him, and we're about to leave. And as he was like kind of getting ready to go, we accidentally kicked into a small rock. And the rock kind of like tumbled into this dark area on the corner of this little mini cave we were in. And he's like, huh, the rock didn't hit anything. Like, I didn't hear a sound. So he kind of looks around, and actually what we looked like just a shadowy place was a very steep entrance into what turned out to be a huge network of lava tunnels underground. And we would have had no idea if he didn't accidentally, you know, kick that rock. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of descended into it. It was very narrow, like we could barely fit in there with all our spacesuits on. And then once we went inside, there were parts where, you know, we could actually build habitat in there, like, you know, really tall ceilings, at least 4 meters or so, pretty wide space. But then suddenly there were parts where we were crawling or actually like lying on the ground and decided, okay, we can't go any further. Let's turn around. And we spent hours underground just trying to map this crazy lava tunnel network. So it really depends. Some of them are tiny but good enough to collect samples, and some of them are huge and you could actually live there.
Do we have an idea of how big they are on Mars or the Moon?
From kind of, you know, indirect data, it looks like it could be a similar thing. You could, because we see these so-called skylights, so they're kind of windows into the underground. So when you would have, for example, a lava tunnel and part of the ceiling would collapse, it would create a hole through which you can kind of look underground. And we see a lot of those on Mars, and those indicate that these lava tunnels could actually be pretty extensive. And the Moon as well, actually, they've actually mapped, I think, at least 200 or so of these lava tunnels there. And I think they're all also of different shapes and sizes. That's why we keep on talking about actually being able to use them as a shelter for human habitat.
Amazing. I kind of, if there's any science fiction writers listening, you know what your next story is based on, right? I mean, lava tubes on the Moon, lava tubes on Mars. What are we going to find when we go down there?
Yeah, I know. Sometimes it's funny doing the research, like being on an EVA. And, you know, you really feel like you're part of, you know, Alien, the movie or something. And you're kind of just expecting something to jump out at you in the darkness in these lava tunnels. So sometimes I play a little prank on the newbies and, you know, do have something actually jump out or fall on them, which is quite quite the scene.
That's amazing. I love it.
I must come across as very evil now that I think about it, but you need to have some humor, you know, in there.
Certainly. I've just decided I'm not going to apply to come on one of these
pitches. Aw, I'm sorry. You know, it's not an easy thing. Like, people always think, oh, well, you're just locked in there for a few days. Not too bad. But, you know, it really has a strong effect on you being part of these missions. Everything is limited. You're constantly, you know, watched. Everything you do, you lose freedom. And that's the thing that I have biggest issue with. And you're always interacting with the same people in a small space. And, you know, it does really provoke people to kind of show their true colors that they wouldn't in a normal working environment. And you have to deal with problems in these kind of more extreme situations. And then it's even the little things like having to eat the same kind of freeze-dried astronauts food every day. That can really get to people, or only having 8 minutes of shower time per week. That, you know, is a big issue for some others. So we end up like in some missions, you know, playing poker to get extra shower time and things like that. So it really depends on how you make it work. If you try to make it work, and even the, you know, try and make the unpleasant things be something funny or something that you can handle, then it's okay. But it's the people who really let it get to them. They're the ones who struggle the most. And as commander, I always try and find ways to make them feel better and more at home and, you know, collaborate with everyone on the crew.
Yeah. I bet this is the thing, that with all of that, you still want to do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, my big dream is to go to space myself one day. So I have to be able to put up with all these things for that to happen.
Well, Cool. I thought you're gonna make it. You're gonna make it to space, and I think
Thank
it's a
you.
very, yeah, it's a very cool thing. It's a very cool thing. I don't know if I'm going to apply for a mission, but I've got to come and see it. Definitely when you get the big, analog, not analog. What's the word? Replica of what's going to be on the moon. I've got to come and see that. It'd be amazing.
Okay, sure, definitely. I'll be posting all updates on my social media, so
Yeah,
feel free to
that's what I was
follow
going to say.
along.
That's what I was going to say. If there's people who do want to apply and do want to follow you on social media, what do they do?
So I have an official Facebook page. It's Mikaela Musilova, astrobiologist and Marsonaut. I know it's a long name. I keep on thinking if I should shorten it some way. But easier to find me on Instagram and Twitter, where I'm astro underscore Mikaela. Or if you just look up Mikaela Musilova, you'll be able to find me, usually wearing an astronaut suit or something in my profile pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. And of
And I
course,
post,
go on.
updates, either during the missions. I try and write blogs and show pictures and things. And in between missions, I kind of post up updates about all the things that we're changing in the habitat, or we do a lot of outreach work. So I kind of post about that. Recently, I had several school children asking me questions, so I recorded little videos answering their questions, like if aliens are real and is d space dangerous and things like that, which is also great fun.
Yeah, so the answer to those two questions is yes and yes.
Yes, basically. That's the short version, but I went for a slightly lengthier answer there.
Absolutely. Well, listen, thanks so much for talking to us. Of course, we will post links to all of your stuff on the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com. And yeah, well, let's stay in touch because it's exciting stuff. And if all else fails, you'll find me crawling up a mountain, crawling down a lava tube in a spacesuit. Let me out!
I would love to see that happen.
Thanks so much to Michaela for talking to us again. It's always wonderful to catch up. And next, we go to the Arctic, and Emma Brisdian is getting involved in some fascinating research into climate science. Now, Emma is part of the Stimulus Network of podcasts and the host of the For What It's Earth podcast. So I caught up with her when she was up in the Arctic.
So I'm based up in the Abisko area of northern Sweden. There's a climate change research centre up here, which is about 100 years old now. It's actually quite big. It can host about 100 people at one time, although it doesn't feel very big when you're here. It still feels quite tiny and quite remote. There's loads of teams and loads of scientists from all around the world who are looking at different elements of climate change in this subarctic environment, because we've got lakes, we've got bogs, we've got mountains, we've got snow cover, we've got quite a fast growing season in the summer, and then we've got loads of ice cover in the winter. So for one place to be based, they can do such an amazing range of research. I'm here talking to a lot of the teams, going out with them in the field, giving them a hand, finding out what they're doing and how their research relates to climate change, and putting it all in a nice little audio format. Producing a podcast called Field Notes on Climate Change. We're literally kind of going out in the field with these scientists. It's really cool because we're kind of at the front lines of Arctic research, and it's quite exciting to be talking about science which is happening in front of your eyes.
And how would people find it if they search for
Field Notes on Climate Change? You should find it. It'll be on iTunes. And then if you have a look at the Climate Impacts Research Centre, any of their Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, it'll be advertised there. And I'll probably heavily promote it on my own Twitter and Instagram.
What are they?
Just Emma Brisdian, so Brisdion.
Speaking of your Instagram, you've been posting some rather wonderful images and you've been making me very jealous.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just tell us a bit about what you're seeing.
So the station is literally based in the most amazing location. It's kind of at the foot of one of the mountains called Mount Nulia, which they do a lot of research up on, and also kind of overlooking this huge lake. It's like 70 kilometers long, Lake Tornetrask, I think is how you pronounce it. I've probably butchered it. My Swedish pronunciation of things is not quite there yet. But yeah, it just means that we've got really varied environments. So I think I've probably been posting quite a lot of pictures of the lake because it's just absolutely beautiful. And the ice melted within a week, which was amazing. So when I arrived, it was kind of almost completely frozen. The cracks were just starting to show. And then, like, bang, within a week, spring had arrived, greenery has started flourishing everywhere, and the lake is now completely open. So some people have been swimming. It's still a little bit cold for my tastes, but I will go in at some point. But yeah, and then I think I've also put up some pictures of kind of some of the plants and things that are around here. And I saw a moose, which was very exciting, just came wandering through the research station.
Hey, that's very cool.
It was massive, yeah. It was only a little one, but it felt massive. So I look forward to seeing a fully fledged one.
Are they quite common up there then?
Yeah, there's heaps of them. And there's loads of reindeer as well, because we're still very much in kind of Sami territory. The indigenous culture of the not so much Sweden, but the northern parts of Lapland. So this is where they kind of used to roam free and herd their reindeer and have a more nomadic lifestyle. They don't really have as much of a nomadic lifestyle these days, but there's still quite a lot of their culture. And in some areas up in Lapland, it's not respected as well as it could be, but it here, particularly in Abisko, they have such a focus on nature and the natural environment that they really do seem to work quite well with the Sami culture.
What's the impact of the climate changing?
Well, it's fascinating because up here, I think the research station is over 100 years old, so they can draw some really interesting kind of data comparisons to sets of data that were taken literally 100 years ago. So you can have a look at how global warming is affecting things like species shift. So because the growing season and the summer is becoming warmer and longer every year, species are able to flourish earlier, but they're also able to move up further north in their range, whether that's like geographically north or also further up a mountain. We've also been doing bird ringing, kind of catching birds to kind of have a look at how their migration is changing over the years, and whether certain species are moving further north in their migration up here or whether they're coming here earlier in the year and things like that. So it's really fascinating that they've got this ability to have a look at data that's a century old, because most climate change research that you start now or have started in the last 20 years are still going to have to wait quite a long time to get two really far apart data sets to make long-term comparisons.
So how do you catch a bird? I was watching a cat in the garden this morning trying to catch a bird. Birds have this major advantage over a cat, which is that they can fly. And you can't fly either, so how do you catch a bird?
We just employ lots of cats, flying cats, really well-trained Arctic cats. No, we've got these really big, soft nets, which we unfurl, and effectively they just fly into them. And we, every half an hour, go around and do a walk around the nets and collect the birds that have been caught. And it doesn't hurt them in any way. And because we do it every half an hour, they're never there for very long. We're not leaving them in distress. But we're also not going too frequently because we don't want to disturb the nets. And if you keep wandering around in that environment too often, the birds will leave and they won't fly into the nets.
You're making this podcast in the subarctic.
Yes. We're also definitely in the Arctic because we're well above the Arctic Circle. So I think it's just possibly a term to stop people assuming that when you say that Abisko, where I am, is in the Arctic, they would assume that it's a nice hut up on the North Pole.
With polar bears wandering around.
Yeah. Yeah. No, just moose and reindeer here.
Yeah, so it's kind of subarctic super Sweden.
Super Sweden, I like that.
You're making that podcast in super Sweden, and but it's not the only podcast you make. And tell us a bit about For What It's Earth.
Ah, so that's my podcast firstborn. It's one that I set up a couple of months ago with my good friend Lloyd, and it's climate change and environment and sustainability themed as well, but it's kind of a lot more relaxed. It's the two of us just sat in a room having a bit of a giggle, and every week we look at a different topic. So whether that's palm oil or climate emergencies or recycling or cosmetics, and every week we sit down and we explain generally what the topic is and what people need to know about it, but then also have a look at the kind of things that you and I can all do to make a little bit of a big difference. So it's about kind of starting conversations about sustainability with people that might not necessarily already be super interested in climate change or environment science, and making that really accessible and providing solutions for anyone who is interested to kind of feel like they are having a bit of an impact and hopefully maybe change their habits in a way that's feasible to them and also good for the environment.
Regular listeners to The Cosmic Shed will know that I bloody love it.
Ah, thanks. You're an absolute champion of For What It's Earth. We've just wrapped up season one because obviously it's logistically quite difficult for me and Lloyd to sit in the same room and record while I'm in Sweden. But season two will be coming back out in the autumn, so you can look out for it.
I'll tell you what, during the summer, while you're breaking, why don't you and Lloyd come and sit in the Cosmic Shed, watch a film, and then let's do an episode?
I'd love to. We'd absolutely love to. You can count us in for that, definitely.
Let's do it.
I do really recommend listening to Field Notes, and of course For What It's Earth. But the Field Notes episodes, Emma follows the scientists as they're up there on the mountainside, and they're putting these pods onto the mountainside so that the temperature in these pods is a degree warmer than it actually is at the moment. And obviously that tells them an awful lot about what's going to happen as the climate warms. And finally, we go to Lizzie Daly, who I met at Cheltenham Science Festival. You'll know Lizzie from BBC TV series, and Lizzie's a biologist and a presenter. I really recommend you follow her on all the social media channels as it currently stands. This last week, she's been on an ocean tour of the UK, going around the coast of the UK and getting up to all sorts of exciting adventures with giant barrel jellyfish. And some really wonderful short videos and photographs from that. Anyway, I caught up with Lizzie at Cheltenham Science Festival.
Strangely, kind of swinging one way to the other, my master's was on ladybird larvae, so a bit of an entomological sprinkle on there, and then a natural transition straight into elephants.
Okay,
see,
yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Of course,
straight
yes.
into elephant research.
Is there any link?
Not that I'm studying, not that I know of. But I was looking at electroreception in ladybirds.
What's that?
So in bees, as I'm sure you know, so bees, as they learn about their environment by detecting floral cues using electric fields with their hairs, the mechanosensory hairs. So they're flying through the environment, they approach a flower, and they're able to learn about how much pollen is on a flower, when a bee last visited, using electric fields in the environment, which is amazing. And my research was looking at whether this may be true in other groups, or coleoptera, basically, so in beetles. To be continued, ... as always with a one-year master's. And now for my, I'm starting a PhD at Swansea, looking at the issues around human and elephant conflict in Kenya.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. I'm just going to step back to electric fields slightly.
Yeah.
So, it's amazing, isn't it? Mm. The way that animals can sense that.
Yeah. It's kind of a new field of research in terms of terrestrial animals. So, we've known quite a while about it in shark species and in our platypus. You know, we know all about those electroreceptors that they've got on their bills and their faces for their ampullae of Lorenzini, all of that. So they're really good at having an electrical sense. But in the terrestrial world, it is fairly new. And most of the research is done in bees, but brand new, was it the end of last year, came out about the ballooning behaviour in spiders, so travelling vast, vast distances by basically putting out a bit of silk into the air, into the environment, and for a very long time, you know, back down to the beagle times, where spiders were on the beagles, it was thought that they got to the beagle by wind, perhaps, being carried, the silk carrying those spiders by wind onto the beagle. As of last year, it's found that actually, largely, it's due to electric fields in the environment.
Really?
Yes, because, I mean, everything in the environment has a different electrical charge. So bees are charged. When they fly, they become more charged. Even a flower, even a stem has a different charge to the leaves and the petals and things. And silk, in particular, is quite charged. And in an environment with the right conditions, that can actually cause a spider, believe it or not, to travel huge distances through the environment.
Just astonishing, isn't it?
It's so cool.
Wait, so just for the record, the beagle being Charles Darwin's badge.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I should have specified, but yeah, I would just assume everyone will know. Yeah. The beagle. Like me and my pals on the beagle.
It's just a dog. Spiders on a dog.
Sorry, yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Charles Darwin referred to, you know, ballooning or spiders being on the beagle, but put it down to things like wind, etc.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing because we often see, well, not often, occasionally we see stories about humans being able to detect magnetic fields. Mm. Any sense on whether that's a load of nonsense or not?
Absolutely no idea. Absolutely no idea. And I fear saying anything on it because, it's not my background. I couldn't say it.
It seems like, because you're talking about receptors. Mm. I'm going to push you on it. You're talking about receptors.
Yeah.
In this. We haven't got any receptors. How could we? Mm. Have spiders got receptors?
Yeah, so the electroreceptors can come in many forms as well. So, say, for example, on a bee, you have mechanosensory hairs. That could technically be a receptor because if that hair moves as a result of an increase in charge. That will then, you know, create an input to the nerve impulse, and that will signal that information to that bee. But for ladybird larvae that I was looking at, they're covered in these big projections, really big projections, and no one really knows why. It's thought that perhaps it's, you know, a bit of a defense, and bright coloration, etc. But it's not conclusive. And I was looking at whether the structure might actually act almost like an antennae, right? So into the environment, they have lots and lots of these antennae, if you like. And if you put an approaching charge on one side, do they behave differently? Do they react? As I said, it was only a short project.
Yeah.
I mean, we're covered in hair.
Yeah.
We use our hair for a variety of things. But is there an element of being able to use information from mechanosensory hairs on humans for that role? I don't know.
I kind of feel like if someone asked me which way north was, I'd be able to tell if I had that, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which seems unlikely. Something else which seems to understand the world around it in a way that we don't is elephants.
Mm.
I guess that's a link.
Nice. I mean, you made that link, aren't
you? what do you look at? Conflict between elephants and humans. Who's winning?
Humans.
Oh.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The blunt answer is human. So I think a lot of people assume conflict is associated with poaching, which largely it is. But in this particular area, it's a place called Laikipia in Kenya. Conflict with humans in the dry season mainly is because of it's dry, there's not enough food, and so there's competition over the crops. So farmers are growing crops in the dry season, elephants have no food or running out of space, there's more people than ever, huge growing human population in Kenya, and the elephants are going in and eating all the people's crops. And that is, for some farmers, that is a daily problem, daily issue. And those crops are those people's livelihood. That's everything. That's what they need to survive. And if an elephant comes along and destroys it all in a night, you know, what do they do? And unfortunately, the people react, of course. They're trying to defend their crops. And so you end up physically having conflict between these humans and elephants. It's really bad.
Really?
Literally is a critical point for some of these farmers. And the other issue is that there's no real, or the mitigation barriers in place at the moment, they're not working. They have fences. How would you defend your crops from a slug or a snail, if not killing them?
So what we do is we put up, I believe, and I think this is not true, but I'm still believing it, that the snails and the slugs have trouble getting over old wood. Right?
Great, so like a physical barrier.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And so I put that up, and they still get through, but at least I've not killed them. So
it's not like they have to like go to the door and give their ID and like...
Is that what the elephants do?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
VIP area only, I'm sorry. Pay entry.
No, but
physical barrier. And right now in Kenya, in this area, elephant-proof fences are the main way that they try and keep all those crops in and let the elephants roam free outside of that. The other tricky issue you have in particularly Laikipia, it's a mosaic of landscapes. So you've got farmland that's spreading and increasing. You've got private land as well. And then in that you have conservancies. But the elephants can kind of roam in and out of that. And in areas where they have these migratory routes, you know, for thousands of years, they've passed through these areas, and they're changing. The landscape is just completely different now.
I've just noticed that you've got an elephant tattooed on your wrist.
Oh, no, I do. It doesn't have an ear. It bothers me. It's so anatomically incorrect.
it's a silhouette.
It's there. It looks like it's got a bit of a wig, though. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. What I was going to ask, I'm not going to critique your tattoo, but what I was going to ask is, did your love of elephants come from before you started studying?
Yes, yeah. I was 6 when I said to my mum, I want to study elephants, and that hasn't changed ever. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you made it.
Yes, yeah, I know. Well, trying to, yeah.
Okay.
Just starting a PhD, I've been told, pre-med's like the biggest thing ever. But,
oh, you're just starting?
Yes, yeah.
So my co-hosts on the Cosmic Shed, the 4 of us, 2 of us have got PhDs. I'm not one of those. And it's nice to have them back. That's what I'll say.
Really?
I don't want to put you off.
Well, it's a big thing. It's a huge, huge project. It takes a very long time.
So what are you going to look at then? How are you going to study it?
Yes, so the idea is... Okay, so one of the ways that they're trying to mitigate the conflict is by using these elephant translocations. So what that involves is if there's a persistent elephant that keeps crop raiding, they'll decide whether to dart it, move it somewhere else where there's less people, and then just release it there. I went to see this when I was in Kenya. And while I was there, I was trying to figure out what I want my PhD to be on. And for me, that was super interesting because... And it's kind of in the elephant research world, it's kind of a known thing that translocating the elephant is just translocating the problem. It's not really based on too much rigorous science. And so for me, that was a gap I really want to explore and want to fill if we're going to mitigate this conflict long term. So yeah, I'm at Swansea University and they have these amazing accelerometers. They put on penguins and they put on a variety of different animals. And the idea will be to use them to put on the collars, the GPS collars of elephants in Kenya, along with an NGO called Space for Giants, and use that to track micro movements and understand behaviour after a translocation.
Oh, and are you going to go and do that?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. So I'm going out in a week to meet with the NGO Space for Giants. I'm going to talk about, you know, whether or how that would work, because the collaring of an elephant is never easy.
No,
I can't just say, excuse me, mate, do you mind if I just...
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to ride you, and while I'm here. Mike, will you let us know how that all goes in a bit?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah.
Let's do that. But you do a lot of other things, right? You do some broadcasting.
Yes, yeah.
People will recognise you from the telly.
Yeah, now and again. Yeah, so I've done BBC Two series Curious Creatures, Animal Planet's new series Solve, Nature's Greatest Mysteries, which is great fun. A little bit out the box, definitely, but really good fun. And Blue Planet Live Lesson. I was very lucky to do that. Yeah, that was brilliant. Really good. Just to kind of have live kids in the studio. And then we were linked to Steve Backshall in the Bahamas. And I just came back from the Bahamas a week before in the same place.
Oh, really?
And he went to the same dive spots with the sharks and stuff there, so that was great. Yeah.
How do you find the you don't know yet, you just started it, but how are you going to do a PhD and all this other stuff?
Yeah, I know, yeah. What will happen is I will do a PhD, slowly crumble as a human, and now and again be on telly and go rah! And then leave.
Sounds amazing. I look forward to it. But you do some conservation work as well.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So very passionate about various campaigns. A new one that recently, well, not new, but it's a successful one. So Gwent Wildlife Trust, they did a campaign to save the Gwent Levels in Newport. So it's not far from me. Fantastic area. You have cranes there. You've got, you know, numerous species of really not endangered, well, some are endangered, but some fantastic species in need of conserving in this area. And there was thoughts of putting an M4 relief road through it, and that's now been cancelled. Last year I made a film about the shooting of seals in Scotland by the salmon farming industry.
Okay.
As a kind of like expose film.
What, can we see that?
Yes, yeah. It's called Silent Slaughter. It's online on my YouTube channel. And the idea was to push to get the shooting of seals by salmon farms banned, or at least the licensing system that's in place to shoot them to be made more strict and regulated.
How's it going?
Well, .. In February, the salmon farm that was included in the film, they came out and wrote this huge article about how they're going to invest millions of pounds to double nets so they won't need to shoot seals anymore. And they said they'll reduce the number of seals being shot to zero in 2019.
Okay.
I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
To be continued, that's all I'm saying, because I'm not sure that's the honest truth.
Okay. Fair enough. It reminds me of when presidents say we're going back to the moon after I've left office.
Literally, just making it up.
Yeah,
keeping everyone happy.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So, you're here at Cheltenham.
Mm.
What are you doing?
Yeah, yesterday we did a weird and wonderful natural world talk for kids. That was great. Talked about various animals from across the world that I've been very lucky to meet. And then today I was here with Professor Ben Garrod and we did our animal top trumps. It's basically a battle between extinct animals versus extant animals.
Wow. Who won?
Oh, I don't want to say. He won it. He totally won it. I did win the last two.
Okay.
I won the last two, so I thought it was in a good running, but...
It's 2-1 then, that's fine.
Yeah. I mean,
that's absolutely fine. Is it finished now?
Yes.
Okay,
it's just
you won over it. That's good. I meant, which animals won?
Well, the last round's quite interesting because I choose the peregrine falcon as the fastest, so we have different rounds. And the last one's speed, and I pick the peregrine falcon, and then he picks the peregrine falcon as well, because technically birds are dinosaurs, right? Well, not technically. They are dinosaurs. So all the kids are like, what?
Yeah.
But they are extant, so...
Yes.
I know, so... He won it by, I think he was just more popular than me. I think that's what was happening. I'm going to put it down to that.
So the kids vote?
Yes. Oh, yeah, they vote by screaming. It's really good fun, actually. It's really good. They love it.
I wondered what that screaming was.
Yeah.
So when you do a lot of stuff with lots of different audiences, right? A lot of children's stuff.
Yeah.
I have a little hope left in me that maybe the future will be better. Do you get a sense when you're dealing with the children on these things? I mean, I guess it's a selective audience. It's the children whose parents want them to come
right.
to your show.
Yeah.
But tell me something positive.
I do. Actually, the online world, I find, gives me more hope than anywhere else at the moment. The kids that come to the talk, as you said, normally, you know, they're sat down, they're ready to see a show, so they're engaged to a certain extent. And actually, they react really well. A nice progression from that is online, I've seen changes using social media and a few young conservationists that are coming through online, and they're using the power of social media for good, and pushing important issues and putting them in the face of the right people in order to make positive change. I feel quite hopeful with younger generations on the whole.
That's brilliant. I'll take that. And good luck with the elephants and the PhD.
Thank you.
And, well, hopefully we'll have you back on the Cosmic Shed to find out about it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
No worries, then.
Well, thank you so much to Lizzie, Emma and Michaela for talking to us. We'll be back very soon with that episode on From the Earth to the Moon. And thank you very much for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.